The Medical Alley podcast is brought to you by MentorMate. Custom software needs vary significantly. Whether you're powering a medical device, overhauling your back-end architecture, or reimagining your patient experience, MentorMate can help. Harnessing the technical excellence of Bulgaria, MentorMate provides end-to-end software services in all sectors of healthcare. With deep expertise in design, development, cloud, and software support, MentorMate helps healthcare clients administer world-class care through technology. Learn more at MentorMate.com. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone out there in Medical Alley. Thank you for joining us again for another episode of the Medical Alley podcast. I am so very pleased today that we have just a wonderful guest, a longtime member, a longtime part of the Medical Alley and the medical technology community, Nadeem Yared, the CEO of CVRX. Nadeem, thank you for joining us today. Maybe you could give us just a short intro on yourself and on CVRX.
Thank you, Frank, and let me take this opportunity here to thank you and the entire Medical Alley group. The work that you have done has impacted not only the Minnesotan patients and the nationwide patients and the Minnesotan-based medical device technology companies, but I can say you have impacted here a lot of medical device companies outside Minnesota in the whole wide world. So we're very proud to be an active and satisfied member in here of Medical Alley. So my name is Nadeem Yared. I am the CEO of a small company based in Minnesota called CVRX. Our company has developed a technology that we call Barostim. Baro stands for pressure and stem is stimulation. So you can guess this is a neurostimulation for baroreceptors. That means pressure sensors in the body. When I say neurostimulator, it's an oversimplification. It's a neuromodulation, to be more exact. We don't stimulate the nerves per se. We stimulate the receptors. That said, our product has been approved by FDA for the treatment of symptoms of heart failure. And that makes it the first device ever to be approved here in the United States that leverages the brain to basically treat a cardiovascular condition. That has been a dream for many decades. You know, Earl Bakken, the founder of Medtronic, with, you know, Dr. Lily High here in Minnesota, a well-known cardiologist in the 60s, they started, you know, experimenting with the similar approach to try to leverage the brain to treat the heart back then. And we finally got an FDA-approved product here in the marketplace. And the product is proudly designed and proudly manufactured in Minnesota. A couple of words about myself. I am an engineer by training. I grew up in Lebanon, moved to France, did my second engineering degree in France, started working for General Electric in their medical imaging division, mostly on the software development, imaging, CT, MRI scanners, and so forth. I took a year off to do an MBA, to move to the dark side, become a marketeer, basically. And after this, it accelerated a little bit. I end up doing an acquisition for General Electric based in Salt Lake City. GE asked me to move my family to go and integrate that business. And when my wife and I discovered life in the United States and how friendly people are and how the environment is so suitable for entrepreneurs and taking initiatives, we decided this is going to become our country. So we voted with our feet, with our hands, with our bodies, and we moved to the United States. And we've been living here in the United States for the past 20 years, very, very happy.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I'll ask about GE in a second, but I know many of the listeners out there are probably familiar with the work of Earl Bakken and Dr. Lila Hai, and particularly some of us have probably seen there was a poster in various forms where Earl decades ago imagined using stimulation to treat head to toe on the body. And bit by bit over the decades, innovative companies, including Medtronic, but many startups have been filling in that map of the body and showing how neurostimulation, neuromodulation can treat so many conditions. So that I really appreciate you sharing that connection to the history of the community.
And we need to give credit here to a woman, Dr. Nina Braunwald. She, the name Braunwald might be familiar to many of our listeners. Professor Braunwald, her husband, Eugene Braunwald, has written all of the modern books of cardiology. So when you go to a physician's office, you see those Braunwald books. His wife, Nina Brownwell, started experimenting on neurostimulation and figuring out the role of the different nerves in the body, particularly in the relationship between the brain and the cardiovascular function. So Earl Bakken was part of this group, Steve O'Julius. Of course, I mentioned Jean Brownwald as a physician, Dr. Lily High. So it's been a long road in here of trying to use electricity everywhere in the body to address different physiology and different anatomy and also different mechanism of action. Very exciting field.
Very much so. And yeah, on the shoulders of giants that we all get to stand and see these amazing things develop that benefit patients around the world. I want to back up just a little bit in your story. You talked about being a GE for a time. And I think GE is just so well known as a leadership development organization. And there are so many GE healthcare alums that are all over the medical technology community. Could you talk a little bit more about that experience and what it was like being in GE during that time and kind of what you've brought forth as you made that switch from the engineering to the dark side of marketing and now leading a startup organization?
Absolutely. So if my memory is correct, Jack Welch took over the chief executive officer position of GE's in the early 80s. And the first few years, he was called the Neutron Jack, if you recall back then, right? So he started fixing the hardware of GE, so what businesses to keep and what businesses to divest. But very shortly after, I think middle of the 80s, 85, 86, in his books, he talked about needing to change the software of GE, which meant the culture. And that led to the creation of the GE University in Crowdenville in upstate New York. And that led to all of that push of creation of that management track within GE. It was in this environment that I joined GE in 92 as an intern. And I got really lucky to work really close to a lot of people. Let me give you some example of names. Dow Wilson was my boss at GE when I returned from my MBA, and he became the CEO of Varian. He just retired recently after Siemens acquired Varian, the radiotherapy company. Pete Arduini, who used to be recently the CEO of Integra Life Science, was just announced to become the CEO of GE Medical, GE Healthcare System. Pete and I shared a cubicle, basically. We had two desks opposite to each other for 6 months at the facility in France. So I end up within the AdvaMed board and Medical Alley meeting with a lot of the people I worked with back in the days. You know, you name them, Mike Mahoney at Boston Scientific, Mike Minogue at Abiomed, and the list goes on. It goes very deep. So you are correct.
Yeah, again, that shoulders of giants and just the through thread of this community shows up in so many places. And you know, intern in 92, joining CVRX a number of years later, but when you joined CVRX, it was a very different med tech environment than what we have today. And you've been a strong advocate of pushing to a more positive time, I'd say. Could you talk about, you know, CVRX getting started and some of that environmental change that we experienced as an industry and, you know, how it's changed in the last couple of years and maybe where there's some work we still have yet to do?
I joined CVRX in late of 2006. And my first year and a half, I was trying to learn about cardiology, about clinical trials, about active implantable devices, about how to be a CEO, how to be managed by and manage a board of directors. You know, it's a interesting symbiotic relationship between a CEO and a board of directors, different than when you are in a large company where you have a boss and you have a direct report. With board of directors, it's different. And also trying to learn the landscape, the investment landscape, you know, with the venture community and so forth. One thing that struck me at the time, 2007, 2008, was the culture at FDA that needed some real attention. And we raised the alarm bells. And you may recall those, Frank, and we did a lot of this effort here in Minnesota. Actually, in one of those situations, Dr. Jeff Shuren, who is still the head, the director of the Center of Device and Radiological Health, CDRH, so that's the a division of FDA that covers all medical devices and diagnostics. So Dr. Shuren was visiting Minnesota, and we had a lot of discussions and talking points, and actually almost attacking him on the need to modify and improve the culture of FDA to become more of a patient-centric, patient-focused culture, rather than a culture more based on policing the medical device industry. Not that we didn't believe in the role of FDA of being a police, but we believed in FDA being the role of a helper, of a guide to the medical device companies to do the right thing. And in one of these town halls here in Minnesota, Dr. Shuren and some of the Minnesotan-based medical device executives, you know some of the names, decided on creating a private-public partnership between FDA, CMS, NIH, the medical device industry, patient advocacy group, hospital system providers, and payers. And they called us, actually we called it, I am one of the founding members, we called this MDIC, the Medical Device Innovation Consortium. So that was actually one important element of the collaborative effort that FDA was starting to do with the researchers, with the medical community, with the industry, the medical device industry. And from my perspective, that was the cornerstone of the beginning of the shift of the culture within FDA. Now, Dr. Shuren worked very hard at this. He actually came to the industry and asked some of the established companies, such as Johnson & Johnson or Medtronic, to help FDA about how do you, as a leader of a large ship, large organization such as FDA, can shift the culture. And nowadays, when you speak with those same superb people, men and women who work at FDA, these same people, you would speak to them 10 or 12 years ago versus today, different tone. You know, 10, 12 years ago, they would tell you, no, you cannot do that. Now they will tell you, well, you cannot do that, but have you considered this or that? Read this paper, read this manuscript, talk to this scientist. And that makes a whole difference in the environment, in the medtech ecosystem. We still have a lot of work to do, particularly on the complicated reimbursement landscape, private and public. But the efforts and the changes that we've seen at FDA just gives us hope that this is possible. It is possible.
Indeed, well said. And yeah, the importance of a community, of an industry coming together and advocating for positive change, you know, that's in the patient's interest, in public health's interest, and the positive impact that that can have has just been amazing to see. You mentioned what, you know, what we hear from a lot of members is probably the most significant emerged, I'd say, challenge today of complex reimbursement, especially for new therapies or therapies that are in areas that previously have been very difficult to treat. That's an environment I think we're all still doing work in. We have seen some progress with this MCIT rule that had been going through, now looks to be coming back. Do you have any thoughts on the reimbursement environment and on the MCIT rule itself?
Absolutely, Frank. But before I answer this question, if I may just give credit here to a very important person in the Minnesotan landscape. So when we talked about the creation of MDIC, Dale Wallstrom actually was the president and CEO of what used to be called Life Science Alley back then, so the Medical Alley now. He was at the core of the creation of that private-public partnership, and he's been an engine here of innovation in Minnesota. So let me talk a little bit about the reimbursement landscape. Anytime we talk about reimbursement, there are three broad categories that we need to think about. So how is the device coded or the procedure coded? What, you know, in the world we live in, we try to create buckets and we try to put every single new technology in an existing bucket. And if it doesn't fit 100%, we need to create a new bucket for it. And that's a new code. And that is very complicated process. It does not have to be complicated, but it is complicated right now. The second element is the coverage, meaning, okay, so we have a code for this procedure. Who are the patients who deserve to be covered by a payer or by Medicare, so the government basically, for this procedure? And coverage determines the eligibility of a patient. And people will be shocked that the coverage space is different than the FDA eligibility space. So FDA can say, well, those five people can receive this device. And CMS will say, no, those six people can receive the device and can be paid for this procedure. Now, those six could be very different than these five, and only the intersection of them, it could be four now, right? Now are allowed to get this procedure in the United States. Allowed because FDA defined what procedure can or cannot be done or what device can or cannot be used. And then CMS will define what patients will be reimbursed or covered by this. And the third chapter of this is the payment, is how much money would CMS reimburses physicians and the hospitals or the service providers for doing this medical act. And those three areas are very different: coding, coverage, and payment. For an so if you take an existing therapy and you optimize it or iterate on it or modify it a little bit, there is a very scientific term that we use in our industry. We call this a better mousetrap. So if you have developed a better mousetrap, usually the coding exists, the payment exists, the coverage exists, so you don't have to worry about this. You have to worry about developing your product and developing the evidence to demonstrate to the FDA that the benefits outweigh the risk. And then you get approved by FDA, and then the product will be sold and paid for by the mechanism that existed previous or prior to your delivering of the product. So developing a mousetrap, a better mousetrap, is easier. Developing an innovative technology, particularly for a disease that is not yet covered. So now you're taking a disease that either did not have a treatment or had maybe a treatment with drugs that were not enough. Now you need a device to take it to the next level. Not only you have to do all of the above, which is develop the prototype, develop the product, run the clinical trial, demonstrate that the benefit outweigh the risk, but also now you have to work and convincing the American Medical Association that your device deserves a new code, convincing payers, CMS from the government, but also private payers, that the payment for this procedure should not be zero, should be something, right? And how much is that? And finally, convincing also the payers, CMS and the private payers, that those patients for whom FDA said the benefit outweigh the risk deserves to receive the product because it is reasonable and necessary for them. And because of that complicated pathway, we end up in a very interesting environment where it's actually more profitable to develop better mousetraps than new technologies or new therapies. And that's not healthy for patients, particularly as we, you know, we discover new diseases and the disease, we discover new mechanism of action. We need to deliver those therapies for the patients who need them. And we've seen so many companies over the years, not only it's more profitable to do a better mousetrap, but the valley, we call it the valley of death, that time between an FDA approval and reimbursement for a novel technology has seen the death of so many medical device companies and medical device products, unfortunately. Those products that FDA said the benefit outweigh the risk, but the company could not convince the payers to cover them or pay for them. And that's that is the part of the environment that we need to keep working on. And it was in this environment that the breakthrough device or breakthrough technologies pathway was developed. It started as an expedited access pathway guidance by FDA. And at the same time, Congress developed the 21st Century Cures that became the Cures Act, that was signed into law by President Obama in December of 2016. So when we talk about a true bipartisan effort, this is, was, and is, and will be a true bipartisan effort. Patients are not D or R. So that the Cures Act defined what a breakthrough technology is, and that allowed FDA to deploy additional resources to help those products that address a morbid condition with a novel therapy that has no substitute. So that's exactly the opposite of a better mousetrap. So now we're talking about diseases that where there are no solutions. You have an entrepreneur, they developed a product, the benefit outweigh the risk. Well, we don't know it yet because it's not yet FDA approved, but we need to prove it. FDA will help this company by deploying resources to help them. That's the breakthrough device technology pathway. Recently, there was a discussion and a lot of effort deployed by both Congress and the administration, but the administration moved faster on this, to take this concept and deploy it within CMS. That led to the streamlining of two payment mechanisms, the NTAP and the TPT. So the new technology add-on payment, both for inpatient and outpatient procedures. Those two processes were streamlined if the product has been defined by FDA as a breakthrough. That was done 2 years ago. What was the project for this year was to also streamline the coverage, to say, all right, you have this new technology. FDA said it's safe and effective for this group of patients. Therefore, CMS will cover those patients if they are Medicare eligible, meaning above the age of 65. That was the proposal of MCIT. Unfortunately, it seems to be more complicated than it appears on paper. We thought it'd be simple, just put it, go and implement it. And while they started the implementation, it appears that CMS found out that it's a little bit more complicated than this. Also, there could be there some discussions about, all right, FDA is defining the products, whether they are or not a breakthrough technologies. Shouldn't CMS also have a say upfront in this, right? So why should CMS delegate all of this to FDA? I contend they should, because they already do it for category A and category B IDE, but they could define the boundaries for FDA to work around. So there is a process in here that could be done. And the other element of it, what if the product is a pediatric product and the pediatric patients are not covered by Medicare, right? So those are among the discussions that led to this situation. But this announcement last week, or was it this week? I'm losing track of time. It was this week, about CMS asking to repeal the MCIT and restart from scratch. From my perspective, that was a stunning reversal, very disappointing, because we can still fix it. We could have still fixed MCIT the way it is with some fine tuning, rather than throw it all out and restart from scratch. That's point number one. Point number two, CMS, by law, they have to open up any decision to public comment, and they did for MCIT, and there were a lot of public comment to support it. Yet it seems to me that CMS decided to ignore the 300 plus public comment they received from physicians, from patient advocacy groups, from medical device industry executives, and so forth, and focus only on a couple of articles placed in a couple of newspapers as op-eds. That was very disappointing, because it's sending to all of us the wrong signal that, you know what, next time, maybe we should not waste our time and submit public comment through the legal process, but rather we'll go to the Wall Street Journals and New York Times of the world and we'll try to place articles in there. And that is not the right thing to do. So in all of this, let me summarize by saying, Frank, we will be working with CMS in here to continue this effort. I started this project 4 or 5 years ago, and I will continue working on behalf of the industry on this. It's not the end of the road. It is a setback for sure. It was disappointing the way it was done so far. But I'm very hopeful that we will find a path forward, because it is the right thing to do.
Indeed. Well said. And I really appreciate you sharing both the policy perspective of it and the history, how we got there. Give us that context for it. And it illuminates something when I think about your commentary there, the commentary on the FDA and the creation of the MDIC. You've been involved. You know, you've been an advocate for industry. You're involved in the associations. You were the first chair of AdvaMed from a startup company, at the time a pre-commercial company even. You know, for the listeners that are out there that maybe are wondering, well, why? Why that much time when running a startup is a lot of work, a lot of time, and now running a commercial company, a public company even? And why put your time and effort into those efforts over so many years?
Excellent question, Frank. There is a very simple answer to it. It is a connected world out there. Somebody has to do it, because every butterfly wing flapping, you know, on the other side of the ocean would affect us on this side. The medical device startup ecosystem relies heavily on venture capital funding. What we've seen in 2008, 2009 is a decrease of capital funding to startup by 75%. So instead of having 100, now you have 25. The problem by dividing it by four is not a division by four of the number of companies that you start. It's dividing by 10 or 100. And why? Because many of those venture capital funds have already companies that started like CVRX. They need to keep funding CVRX. So guess what they would stop doing? Is investing in a new company. So you have a couple of researchers in a university discovering a great idea, patenting it, yet they cannot find the Series A funding to create the company. Continue. Why? Because that Series A funding now has been used on CVRX and Inspire Medical and other companies that needed to continue the pathway. So that division by four of the capital available to medical device startups did not mean division by four of the startup of the creation. It was much more dramatic than that. And that is not a sustainable way to continue. That's number one. Number two, we needed to have a healthy ecosystem from the beginning, but also from the end, because it's a push and a pull. If we do not have enough exits, that means Medtronic acquiring small companies or small companies doing an IPO to float with their, you know, to fly with their own wings, then the VCs cannot justify to invest money in the beginning, right? So you need that pull from the end to be able to invest at the beginning. At the same time, as you have to have enough money available to create this beginning. I was looking at what happened to the car industry, the American car industries in the 70s and 80s. A lot of consolidation, not enough, the environment was not suitable to allow startups. We end up having phantom cities like Detroit happening because of that. You know, three large companies, and you know, they gobbled, they acquired everything around them, and then there is no innovation, and you have to wait until Tesla came about to restart that innovation. I did not want to see that happening to the medical device industry, because it will hurt me. It will hurt, you know, patients, friends, families. I know that they need these devices. It will hurt my peers, my colleagues, other CEOs creating companies, other inventors. And I cannot just say, you know what? I don't care about all of this. I need to focus on my company and let it be. No, I cannot let it be. I have to be part of the solution. And even if I'm the only one, I'm going to raise this flag and keep fighting to make it happen. Now, luckily, I'm not the only one. We're a lot of us CEOs of the medical device industry, particularly in Minnesota. We have a lot of energy and we have a lot of ideas and we have a lot of stamina, and we fight as a block.
Indeed. Well said. Well said. Last question I'll ask. I want to transition to a little bit of what you just talked about with the needing the push and the pull. CVRX recently went public. I'm just curious, maybe in closing, could you talk a little bit about what was it like going public, and what's it like now being a public company CEO? You talked earlier about, you know, the transition and learning about the symbiotic relationship between a board and CEO. You've now got the public company shareholders in there. How has your world changed?
Wow, great question. So let's start first talking about the timeline and why now for CVRX and why an IPO. When we get to a point in the stage of growth of an emerging growth company like CVRX, you need now to start deploying investments to create a larger sales and support infrastructure. You have already eliminated, or the technical term here is retired. We have already retired the development risk because the product has been developed, the manufacturing risk, the clinical risk, the product is FDA approved. And in the case of the CVRX, most of the reimbursement risk. Now, our product is paid for very well with the new technology add-on payment and TPT by CMS. We have a really nice process in here to get all of the patients who need the device to get access to it. So we retired all of this risk. What is left for CVRX is to demonstrate now the adoption in the marketplace, and that requires developing the marketing and the sales and support infrastructure. And using venture money to do this, from my personal perspective, is not the right usage of the venture money. The venture money is dedicated and is designed to take a higher level of risk for a higher return. So they're willing to take the development risk, the clinical risk, which are more binary, And when you get to that point where CVRx is not anymore a binary risk, but it's more about the execution story, meaning how fast are we growing? That's the question mark. Then the venture funds are not adequate for the stage we're in. And that's why we turned toward the public markets and we do the IPO to have access now to the funds from public investors. We did a very successful IPO and now we're well funded to develop that marketing and sales and support infrastructure. So we're very happy with this. Now, telling you all of that story, I forgot the other questions.
No problem at all. So the second part of the question was, what's it like being a public company CEO now? Because earlier you had talked about that symbiotic relationship, board and CEO, and now you've got the public stakeholders in there. How has your world changed?
Not much. I would say not much. I'm enjoying the spotlight. Some people may not enjoy it. I love the spotlight. I love the questions. I love being out there and explaining and telling the CVRx story. So now we have many more investors than we had in the past, but the same responsibility we had to share the information with investors, we used to do it privately, now we do it publicly, but it is the same. Okay, so there are a little bit more regulations and rules about when and how to do these versus a private company. But other than this, it's the same level of information that I used to share with a smaller number of investors. Now I share it with a larger number of investors. Where it could become a little bit interesting is now, if we had a direct competitor, now all they have to do is turn on the radio basically and listen to me speak every quarter and they'll get a lot of information, right? So as a company, you cannot go public if you still have a lot of trade secrets that you're dealing with in terms of, for example, innovating a new pricing structure or a new business model, etc. That's not the time to go public. For CVRx, we've done all of this. Now it's all about the execution. And it was absolutely the time to go public. We love what we're doing. We love the fact that the product is designed and manufactured here in the heartland of the United States. And we intend to keep it as such. And the best path forward for us was to stay independent and do an IPO. And I'm loving every day of it.
Oh, that's fantastic. I really appreciate you sharing that. And I think that's a great point to end it on. So I'll say, Nadim, thank you so much for the fantastic discussion. Always insightful, always informative. And appreciate you spending your time with us.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you to the entire team of Medical Ally for all what you've done for our patients and our industry.
Thank you. And folks, that was the Medical Ally podcast. If you haven't subscribed, make sure you go to medicalallypodcast.org or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcast fix. Have a great day.